I'm Gab. He's Natum in for Jules. It's the Gab and Jules Show. Natum, welcome aboard. We have a packed show today because obviously we've got seemingly nobody wants to finish fourth in the yes, Premier League. We've got Barcelona last-minute winner from Luke de Jong. How I wish Jules was there to see that. We've got new league leaders in Serie A with Milan going forward. But let's start in a place that supposedly your people don't care about.
Okay.
The Club World Cup.
Was that on this weekend?
It was. It was on Sunday.
Right, okay.
Saturday even. Chelsea beating Palmeiras in the final with a dramatic goal from, or dramatic because it was late, from Kai Havertz. I want to get into you a little bit about this competition. I was struck by something because there were, I knew this always happens, right? There's a sense here that is a bit of a tin pot. But when I looked at the way the Chelsea players celebrated, and it wasn't just because their boss, Roman Abramovich, was in the stands.
Well, yeah.
They really cared about this.
Yeah, I think of course you do. Of course you do. It's one of those tournaments, events type things where, you know, you don't just automatically get it. You have to win the Champions League to get the opportunity to do just this. So when you're there, and what's the title? Being champions of the world. And you're playing against a side who are desperate to win it as well. Like, it's not a preseason game. There's an energy to it. And it's something, if you win it, most people will never even come close to even having the opportunity to do it. So to be able to do it, I think it's fantastic. That's why you have to celebrate it. Because I think I was on a show on the weekend as it was going on, and somebody said, oh, they must be so stressed out because, you know, they're doing this tournament now, but they look back at the Premier League and they're 15 points behind City, blah, blah, blah. I said, maybe, but I bet you City would want to be in their shoes right now at the Club World Cup because it would mean that they've won the Champions League.
Yeah.
So let's be clear, it's a huge honour to win. I think there's a sense of apathy about it, but yeah, I know where you're coming from.
It also strikes me, like, you know, you want to talk stress.
Mm.
Chelsea are third in the Premier League.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, they could drop out of the top four. They probably won't. They're not going to catch City at the top of the table. I'll go out, come on the record and say that.
Very brave of you.
They have the Champions League to play for, some domestic tittle-tattle. But, you know, I don't think it's that much of a stress. This is a new competition. I mean, they would have played Arsenal this weekend, obviously London Derby, whatever, and they'll play that game later. But I don't think the Premier League is a stress necessarily for the individual players. I think what maybe stresses them and gets them going is the Champions League or whatever. But at this stage, they've got nothing to ask of the Premier League season.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think if the teams behind them would have been winning their games in hand, then it would have been a lot closer, because I think Spurs were right on the verge, Arsenal to a certain extent as well, but they seem to have faltered kind of at the same time. So you're not really feeling the press from there. And then as for the title race, as you've said yourself, you know, they're not really going to be catching Liverpool nor City. So I think the Premier League is something which they're going to go through, but they want to defend their title in the Champions League, and that's every chance.
What I thought was interesting was in these two games that we saw from Chelsea, where we talked about how Chelsea have been, they've blown hot and cold for, what, the last 3 months?
Yeah, essentially, yeah.
And it looks like Tuchel keeps trying to find the right balance and whatever. He moved to a four when his wing back's out, and we saw it again in the three. It doesn't seem to be coming together. I mean, they beat Al Hilal in the semifinal. Where they beat Palmeiras in the final. Mm-hmm. I think both deserved victories, but really tight games.
Yeah. But would you not expect it to be tight when you're playing for something like that, when you're playing, say, the continent's best and so on? You would expect it to be tight. For Chelsea, for as good as they are, I think we at times are guilty of just saying, well, this is Chelsea, so they must win, they have to win. But this is the title. Abramovich has never won this, has he? This is the first time winning it, I believe. So there's no walkover, is it?
I guess what I'm driving at is you have much better players than the opposition. You have much more highly paid players than the opposition.
Yeah.
You're the European champion.
Yeah.
And still, over those two games, no matter how hard fought the games were, you didn't dominate. Now, was that because Palmeiras, especially in this final, you know, they set up to kind of create this war of attrition? I thought they were quite defensive, played on the counter. And, you know, unless Chelsea get an early goal, they're not in that place right now, especially when, you know, Mount going off in the first half, where they necessarily have, they're not the well-oiled machine, chance creation machine that other clubs are.
No, I would agree with that. But then I don't think they ever really have been under Tuchel, but they've won games and they've controlled games in a certain manner. I don't think they're the side where you expect to see them score four or five goals, even with Lukaku and so on playing. But they still find ways to win. That's how they've won a Champions League. That's how they're in the position that they're in now. And I think, again, you need to give credit to the opposition, I feel, because what they did is they don't play into Chelsea's strengths. And as a consequence, they try and change the game to make it more of a war of attrition. And to add to it, even though Chelsea have more talent, essentially, or in our opinion, the other team still has enough talent to be able to beat you. And that's the reality of football. And I think sometimes we do forget that.
A word on Chelsea, because we've both touched upon this about how they're not firing in all cylinders. Yep. And Jules and I have, you know, we've looked at all the different reasons why. I think we both agree that, I think it's obviously multiple factors. There's a lack of chemistry in the attack because people keep getting injured, moving in and out. Mm-hmm. You know, Lukaku is very different from Werner when he plays. Ziyech is very different from Pulisic. It just all keeps changing, yeah. And it's difficult to build those patterns of play. And obviously midfield as well, when, you know, you've got Jorginho, Kovacic, and Kante, they're all great, but they're all really different.
Yeah.
So if you play Kovacic and Kante like they did in the final,
yeah,
you lose something. If you play Jorginho in place of Kovacic, you lose something, right?
Yeah.
Now Tuchel having COVID, meaning that he has to self-isolate, he only flew in just hours, I think, before this game. How big a setback is it not having your manager there? Or do you generally think it's not really that big a deal because in training, you know, he just tells his servants and they don't execute?
I think it depends, firstly, if you like him. if you don't like him, he's like, oh, he's got to isolate. Oh, that's such a shame, such a shame. But right. But genuinely,
would you have missed Mancini if he'd been isolating?
Yeah, let's not get into that. But anyway, I would say for Tuchel, the videos that I've seen, he can be quite hands-on in terms of the way that he coaches. And for some people, that can be quite intense, but it's very direct because you can't help but pick up on exactly what he wants based on how he's saying things and how he's delivering it to you. Because sometimes with these managers, they'll literally like grab you by the shoulders and put you in the right place. So you'll miss that because an assistant coming over and doing it doesn't have the same effect because the plan feels like it comes down from the top and he's the top and the assistants are there to try and aid in that. But I think at the end of the day for Chelsea, the style of play, it doesn't change that much. So I think they might have missed certain things in terms of his character, personality, people speaking to him and so on. But it should be just finer details as you go into games. It shouldn't be like wholesale changes, should it? So I don't think it's that big a deal.
But does it change longer term? Because he's not, in terms of fixing Chelsea's issues.
Mm.
Like, for example, when they were forced to move to the four,
yeah,
and we saw Ziyech on the wing,
mm-hmm.
he was really, really good.
Yeah.
He's much better in that position.
Yeah.
I think you could argue that Pulisic is also much better from wide areas, at least on this Chelsea team. And maybe Lukaku enjoys that more. I mean, it looks to me like Lukaku and Havertz, for example. I mean, Lukaku's played in front too.
Yeah.
Played in front too last year. But whether he plays with Havertz or with Werner, you don't have the understanding there that he had last year with Lautaro Martinez.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting spot for a manager because the way they go to a four and you get the best from Ziyech, but the manager, you feel more confident with the three. You know, that's his system, that's his base. And it's like, well, are you going to change what you believe in to suit one or two people? And the likelihood is, I think, for the top managers, you have to say no. Because otherwise, like, if your principles start to crumble, the next place he goes to, if he says, I'm Thomas Tuchel, sometimes I play a four, sometimes I play a three, but then, you know, if we're struggling, I'll switch it so that this player's happy or that player's happy. It's not really the strategy you want. I think you want somebody who's going to be come in and just be sort of firm and have his beliefs and stick to them and coach those players to do it, because I think last year they were doing that.
See, that's really curious to me, what you're saying
there. Go on.
Because for two reasons. First of all, when I own a football club, I'm going to hire a manager who, first and foremost, says, especially if I have money tied up in players,
yeah,
I'm going to go to him and say, listen, I'm not Mansoor. I can't go and sell everybody and bring in a whole bunch of guys you want.
Mm-hmm.
Can you do a better job with the guys who are here than the guy you're replacing? And can you adapt your system to that?
Yeah.
That would be my first thing. And the other thing is, specifically with Tuchel, you know, he was a super attacking manager earlier in his career.
Yeah.
Then he became a more defensive one. He's played a three. He's played a four. This is actually somebody who's played a whole bunch of different systems.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems weird to me that now he's very much fixated on this back three. which obviously delivered the championship. So he's not wrong to do it.
Yeah.
But it is somebody where I kind of feel like Chelsea have so many players who are on similar levels.
Yeah.
That you're not going to necessarily, and then they seemingly change in many key positions every week, that it's hard to really have a defined system because who's important might change week to week.
Yeah, to go through the first thing you said, my first question would be, how did you recruit the players? Did you recruit them to play in a certain style or just recruit them because they're just good players and you just want them at your football club?
And because I had a bunch of crappy managers before who I've now sacked.
Okay.
And they went to my idiot sporting director and said, oh, buy him, and he bought them.
Okay. So
we're mid-table, we're okay, but you know they're not bad players.
So the new manager coming in would be to do what? To get you really flying up the table?
To get the best out of the players I have.
Okay. I think I prefer the managers who have a certain style because then that's what you buy into. And you can make a choice then from the get-go whether you want that for your club and for the players that you have, whether you believe that they'll be able to do it. Like, say, Ziyech, for example. Somebody who's played in the Netherlands, right, which is obsessed with 4-3-3, and all of a sudden they play a 4-3-3 at Chelsea and he looks like he's incredible. Well, that kind of makes sense.
So why sign Ziyech? I mean, I guess Tuchel inherited him, right?
There you go, yeah. That's the difference. But Ziyech is still capable of playing in the system that Tuchel has been playing for the majority of his time at Chelsea because he's a very good player and he can be coached to understand it. Whether or not you get the absolute best out of him, I'm not sure, because I would argue, you know, like, I hate sounding like I'm a shill for Man City or whatever, but there are players who play in that team who, in my opinion, don't play to their absolute best, but they do what's right for the team and the collective, and as a consequence, they look very good.
I think if your manager, and I don't know that could ever afford to hire Pep or Jurgen, I think when you've got one of those guys, it's a bit different.
You don't think Tuchel's one of those guys?
I don't think he's on that level, no. Do you? Would you put Thomas Tuchel on the same level as Pep Guardiola? Come on, this is an easy answer.
This is a very easy answer. It's a very easy answer, but Tuchel, head-to-head against Pep, has up until recently, was doing quite well.
That's fine. Doesn't mean he's a better manager.
But I don't think that's a coincidence, though. I think there's something about it. But I understand where you're coming from, and it's interesting. It is very, very interesting, because I think I like what he does, and I think if I was playing for him, I'd rather he was consistent, and then if he failed, like, it failed because it wasn't right. Maybe the next person to come in might be right. But in terms of changing just to appease people, one or two in the team, I think it misses the point.
Well, it's interesting because, not that I want to tie everything into Ralf Rangnick and Manchester United, I think it's very evident that Rangnick is somebody with a philosophy and a style of play.
Mm-hmm.
And he's come in mid-season. He hasn't had time, or he tried it early on. It didn't work.
Yeah.
He hasn't had time to work on it because it takes a lot of work and it takes certain types of players.
Yeah.
And now he's adapted to the players that he has.
Mm. And how's that going for him?
I mean, the results haven't been great in their last three games, as you know, as you're loving the fact that, you know, knocked out of the FA Cup, two draws after that. But equally, they have created a lot of chances.
Yes, they have, yeah.
So, well, but I don't know. Like, it's an eternal thing, right? And obviously, people will come out and say, well, the answer's always in the middle. You need to have certain principles, blah, blah, blah. But I just think it's an interesting thing for Tuchel. And I think, especially with a view towards the summer, right? Especially with Conte and Jorginho getting older. At the back, obviously, Christensen and Rudiger, free agents.
Yeah.
Recruitment becomes more important.
Yes.
And also Chelsea are going to have to start shifting some of these players that they have on their books who, you know, have value, but they're going to have to try to get some money back.
Mm-hmm.
I think recruitment becomes absolutely, absolutely critical. And I think how Tuchel interacts with their recruitment people is going to be very, very important to see how they can go to the next level.
And as he's recruiting, do you think he's going to be recruiting people to fit the system or just good players who might be okay with whatever system they go upon on any given
week? Tuchel has used many different systems. In some ways, we're so wedded to this idea of him with a back three, right? But he's playing a back three because he's got a lot of very good central defenders, right? If Rudiger and Christensen aren't there, maybe I don't replace both of them. Maybe I just bring one guy in.
Mm-hmm.
And then I put my faith in Chalaba and you know, or whatever, right? I don't, and maybe I play back four next year. You know, I don't think in his head, you know, he says like, I must play a back three, right? If he starts believing that the players in other areas of the pitch are more important to him, I mean, I think he also plays a back three because you know, defensively, if Conte's going to get, you know, Conte's obviously had a lot of injuries, but if Conte's going to run around and press high, and you know, Jorginho isn't exactly the second coming of Roy Keane, maybe that's part of the reason why he plays a back three. Maybe he doesn't necessarily trust Reece James and Ben Chilwell defensively the way he might have. So I think a lot of these things come into the equation. I do think it has a negative knock-on effect on his front men.
Yeah.
Because I don't know that this is the greatest system for them the way they're set up, especially if there's this continuous upheaval, continuous turnover of the people who play in his front three.
Yeah.
One of those guys I want to ask you about is Kai Havertz.
Yes.
Because scores the winner on Saturday, scored the winner in the Champions League final, of course. He cost an enormous amount of money. He's still very young.
Yeah.
If you watch him in person, I made this point before, he looks like one of the most, I mean, he looks much better when you see him in person in terms of his ability to do things.
Yeah.
His combination of size, strength, touch. He also, he's not slow. Like,
because
of his build, he doesn't, you know, he's not necessarily going to look like Raheem Sterling.
Yeah.
But he's a really good athlete as well. When you put those things together, is he, you know, when he arrived, I thought he was still quite raw and they weren't sure what his best position was. What do you make of his progress since he's been here? 18 months in. Yeah, I think it's fair to say he hasn't lived up to his transfer fee yet.
Yeah.
But how do you see his development arc?
I think yes is the key, because you can see the potential in terms of him understanding what it is to be playing in the Premier League week in, week out. And then, as you said at the top, he scored the winner in the Champions League final and the World Cup final. So there is some value there, because those are two huge moments where he stepped up and made the difference and been the difference. So I think he has come a long way. But I think for me, it just felt like it was a really slow start to begin with. He just seemed a bit weak, soft, you know, wasn't quite getting up to the pace of the game straight away. But I think he's starting to get a better feel for it. But yeah, I don't know, in some ways, I think he, at times, in my opinion, feels better when other people around him are doing better as well. I don't think he's at the stage yet whereby he can just be the one that has a spectacular game.
He's not going to carry a team.
Yeah, I don't think he's there yet. Maybe his style of play means that he will never be there, but he's still a fantastic player. But this time is potential. But for Chelsea, like, they've got so many other players who can play instead of him, that is tough, because then the argument, like, oh, he's a young player, that's when it plays against him. Oh, well, you know, he'll be good in the future. Yeah. But he's been playing for a number of years now, so you can't talk future talk to somebody that's already started their career, as I say, from a number of years ago.
I think it's really hard to define what his best position is.
Yeah.
And it's also, I like the idea of a Havertz-Lukaku partnership. But I don't know if they're going to get enough minutes together to make it work.
Because of Werner,
because of the continuous upheaval in this team. Because if you play Havertz and Lukaku together as a two, you know, you've got Mount behind kind of on his own, and you're relying on service from wingbacks who may or may not be there. It's weird. It's just like the pieces don't fit.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of faith in Tuchel that he can make the pieces fit, but I kind of expected him to work this out sooner.
Do you think the reason the pieces don't really fit like this is because people are sometimes in, sometimes out, big injuries, somebody comes back, totally, all this stuff. So we've not... Have we? Well, he's had time. He's been there over a year. But I wonder what his first choice team would be if he could pick it week in, week out.
I'm not sure he's clear on that either. I don't know. I don't even think that side necessarily bothers him, but I do think it is affecting the development of some of his players. I want to go back to the issue of the Club World Cup. I pointed this out last week. I think so much of it has to do with kind of the football narratives growing up. So when I grew up, I read stories about legendary games in the 60s when it was a two-legged game between the winners of South America and Europe, and you know, you really didn't know anything about the other team. There was no TV, there was no internet. Later, when the game moved to Tokyo, I had the privilege of attending it when I was a kid, because I lived in Tokyo at the time. I watched the Juventus Argentinos Juniors final in 1985, I think it was. So for me, there's a big mythology to it. Later, you know, I remember getting up way early to watch Milan play after Sacchi's Milan, after they won the European Cup. People in England haven't grown up with that.
No.
I was on the show with Stevie Nicol last night, and he talked about how, you know, when they went out there and played more than once. I think they played Flamengo, and the message from the club is like, okay, boys, take it easy. They were treating it like a jolly, like, you know, like when you go on tour. Mm-hmm. And Zico's Flamengo, like, they scored like 3 times in the first half hour or whatnot. And then all of a sudden, wait, we're supposed to take it easy, and these guys are going a million miles an hour, right? Mm-hmm. I think that impacts the narrative, right?
Yeah.
People in England didn't grow up seeing that. Yeah. And then you had the European bands. You didn't see it again. You didn't actually see a team, an English team, competing in it until, was it 2000? The treble winners were the first team that competed in this game since Stevie's Liverpool on a jolly in Tokyo.
Yeah.
I think that has a lot to do with it. But you go to South America and it's enormous. The number of Palmeiras fans, it's not, you know, Sao Paulo to Abu Dhabi is a long, expensive flight.
Yeah.
And there was a ton of Palmeiras fans there.
Yeah. You make this a very, very good point. And just for clarity, I wasn't raised in the same era as you, so I want to separate myself from that. I'm still relatively young. But I do understand where you're coming from. And yeah, to think about sort of historic English teams at the Club World Cup, I can't think of many. I feel like I remember one where Romario dinked one over, like did a flick over centre-back and then slotted through on the other side. Do you remember that one? Was that Man United they were playing against?
That might have been the weird experimental one that they did in Brazil when the year United couldn't play in the FA Cup as a result.
Possibly, yeah. So, you know, like even that, the fact that you get punished for going. And yeah, it's strange. I think in some ways, most people over here would probably view it as an exhibition. We don't make a big deal about it. You're not really talking about it in the build-up, seeing tons of adverts on television for it, saying who's involved. There's nothing like, you know, the team that wins the Champions League, it feels like that's the end of the road. There's nothing else to it. But then the team that ends up going and winning it, they're very proud because now they call themselves world champions. But nobody in England overall cares. Like, obviously, that's an exaggeration, but it's not a talking point.
Yeah, but I just think it's because it's not part of English football's institutional memory.
No, I agree.
I think but if we throw forward, if we talk about the world, then obviously you're English, but you're also Nigerian, and you kind of understand how football's not just played in Europe.
Yes.
The idea that to call yourself world champion because you enter a tournament and you beat the champions of all the other equivalent Champions Leagues, I mean, that should be a pretty straightforward thing to understand, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And the fact that, sure, all the money's here and the European teams are a lot richer and generally a lot better, although the games are close.
Yes.
That shouldn't detract from it, should it?
No, it shouldn't. But I think in thinking about it now, the issue that they have is the first hurdle of winning the Champions League. So you wouldn't even talk about, say, a Club World Championship. Like, say you finish in the top four, it means you qualify for the Champions League. That's an exciting thing. That's a goal. You've earned the right to be there. But you have to win the Champions League.
And so that's the more difficult. That's the most difficult part of the journey.
Psychologically, that I imagine for lots of teams and people, that feels like the toughest part of the journey. And even within that, not everybody in the nation cares that an English team has won the Champions League if it doesn't affect their team at all. I think there's some people who love the game of football who would love to see Palmeiras versus Chelsea. But then in the same breath, if it was Palmeiras versus, say, another team from Europe or something, they probably wouldn't tune in to watch it, even though it's a very significant thing, as you've said.
I think we know they wouldn't, because some years it's not even on TV.
Well, there you go. There you go. And it's a shame that it is like that, because it must be for the people. So I think Liverpool won it 2 years ago, and I'm friends with somebody in the team, and like Jordan Henderson, he's honoured to have been a world champion, you know, to have lifted a trophy saying, I am world champion. Like, what more could you like ask for as a player at that point, club-wise? You've won the league, won the Champions League, won the Club World Cup. You've completed it, haven't you? That's the full thing, isn't it? But Yeah, I don't know. The UK in general is very funny about certain things, and I think there's a belief that the Premier League is the be-all and end-all of everything. And if the Premier League, you know, they go out and win the Champions League, then that's great. But it just means the Premier League's great. And the World Club World side of things, nobody cares because nobody... Obviously, I'm exaggerating here. Nobody cares because they don't know about Palmeiras. They don't know about Al Ahly. They don't know about, you know, other teams, Al Hilal and things like that. But for all the people who know the world context of it all, then it's a great tournament.
We don't... I mean, look... I do this for a living. I knew about Palmeiras because obviously they won the last two Copa Libertadores. But I know, follow Al Hilal, Al Ahly. You know, I have no idea what's up with his team.
Mm-hmm.
So I can imagine like the man in the street who doesn't get paid to know about these teams. So you're missing that part. But let me ask you this. When the World Cup comes around, right, mm-hmm. and England are playing... Panama.
Yes.
Like they did in the last World Cup.
Yes.
What did you know about Panama? I know a bunch of those guys played in MLS, but pretend you weren't an MLS footballer, right?
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't detract from people tuning in.
No.
So let me throw you this, because there have been plans for this. They've been shelved now. Would this be more meaningful if you had a Club World Cup that was structured like the proper World Cup? In other words, played in the summer,
mm-hmm.
24, 32 teams. You have maybe 8 teams from Europe,
mm-hmm.
6 teams from South America. The rest you fill out from different areas of the world. Would that... I know it would get more interest because you'd have the big European teams facing each other.
Yeah.
But is that something you'd like to see as a fan? Do you think that would help the rest of the world?
I think there would be more buy-in, especially at a point where there's not much going on in the summer. But the clubs I don't think they take it seriously, just because the summer's like their break time and so on, and they say, oh, and for the players, we want to make sure they're well rested, recovered, and all this stuff. And if it's the year after Euros or a World Cup, it's not going to work. But I think that's very interesting. I think to make it more accessible, in fact, it's a gift and a curse, isn't it? Like, only one team can qualify for it from Europe, and it's like a tremendous honour. But unfortunately, it means that most people aren't interested unless they're specific to that team. But then if you add other teams going to it and it's easier to qualify for, then I don't know.
This is the big thing, right? Because obviously Gianni Infantino had a whole plan for this.
Mm-hmm.
UEFA, well, also the way he put the plan together with SoftBank without telling other confederations annoyed them.
As you do.
UEFA, I think, stood up and says, well, wait a minute, this is going to detract from the Champions League. We need to negotiate. Eventually, the whole thing got shelved, and now we're talking World Cup every 2 years. We kind of moved on from that. I personally, if we want to help club football in the rest of the world, if we want local rich people to put their money into local club football rather than all coming to Europe and buying European clubs,
mm-hmm.
stuff like this is going to help.
Yeah.
And I think if you play the tournament at the end of the season, you can say, like, English teams wouldn't care.
Yeah.
But you know what? What are you talking about? Because I look at Manchester City, right? I guarantee you Pep Guardiola would care. He's obsessed with winning the Champions League.
Yeah, of course.
The owners are obviously would care because they probably play it in their backyard. the City South American players would care. Would Kyle Walker not care? Would John Stones not care? Would Jack Grealish not give you? But you know what I mean? Like,
I think you'd care to win it. I think you'd care to win it and to be, in some ways, be a part of it. But I was more so thinking about just the overall feeling around people who'd be tuning in to watch it as such. Because it'll almost get classed as another elitist type tournament. And
we still have to qualify for it.
Yeah. I totally understand what you're saying.
Why don't you revisit a few things? We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/gab. Just go to Indeed.com/gab. Gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. All right, enough Club World Cup. How about some quick hits instead?
Andiamo, let's go.
Nice one. Tottenham Hotspur are beaten at home by Wolves 2-0, Nathan. Antonio Conte has not lost three straight games since 2009. Crazy. When he was managing Atalanta. Bad Atalanta at the time. What's going on?
Yeah, it's not looking good, is it? I thought, with the games in hand, I thought they'd be flying up the league table. But they've stalled so badly. And the worst thing is the Southampton game and the last game. It feels like they were kind of comprehensively beaten, and both of those games were at home as well. So that's a bit of a warning, especially because the next league game is against Man City as well.
Interesting, because as a defender, you don't go and blame all the boneheaded individual mistakes by your colleagues.
It's never about just the defenders. It's the collective, Gab. It's the collective.
It's interesting because Conte made the point that, you know, he thought that they played better in the second half and they created chances, which they did. Mm. I don't think he hung his defenders out to dry, but he was also very big about managing expectations here. He says, like, you know, we're not ready to compete for certain things.
But why? Why is that? You can say that. And you can, like, comparatively against Chelsea in the matchups, they've looked particularly poor. But they've played home against Southampton and played home
Southampton
against...
Southampton are good. Against,
what Spurs?
Yeah, not good.
All right, anyway. So, Luke de Jong is unloved by some, including Julian Laurent. But he came up big to save a point for Barcelona in the Catalan derby against Espanyol. Gab, did Xavi deserve his point?
So, I'm going to say, like, I think he should be happy that he has the point. I don't think Barcelona played well. Espanyol really, really, they got the game plan right. Mm-hmm. In midfield, you know, it's funny, Jules likes to talk, bad de Jong. Well, no, bad de Jong was the other de Jong.
Yeah.
Frankie really, really struggled in this game, as did Busquets. Espanyol flooded the midfield. Sergio Dest scoring a tremendous goal. Eric Garcia making a massive defensive blunder.
Yeah.
In the end, you know, we talk about Xavi philosophy, whatever. I'm sure we'll get there at some point. But the goal came because you put your big lump up front.
Yeah.
And he had a tremendous header.
Yeah.
And I have max respect for Luke de Jong. I said it before. He can be useful to this team.
Yeah.
People are saying, like, oh, look, oh, when Alba's back. Yeah, okay. Let's wait and see. If Alba, who hasn't played in months, can give you more production in those situations than Luke de Jong. Oh, and by the way, enough of this Ferran Torres false nine. Ferran Torres played center forward.
Thank you.
Simple.
Say no more.
Last time they played, Bayern beat Bochum 7-0. This time they lose 4-2, conceding four first-half goals for the first time in nearly 50 years. Nathan, I see a pattern here.
Because attack the defenders.
Many are pointing fingers at Nicolas Sule and Daya Upamecano, both of whom I think it's fair to say had stinkers. As a former defender, is that fair? Or do you want to go and blame them for setting up with just one genuine midfielder in Joshua Kimmich in front of him?
Well, you can say stuff about a system, but when you're making mistakes, it's very hard to say it's the system's fault as such, because as I watched the goals back, there were times when they were so open and they were missing the, like, 1v1s, duels and stuff like this. And that's not good. You know what I mean? That's not good. You can't escape that. But then I wonder how much of that also comes with not having, like, Neuer behind you and stuff. Because I spoke with Schweinsteiger earlier in the year, or last year rather, and he was asked the question, who's the best player you've ever played with? And he said Manuel Neuer. And he said because he completely changes the way that you play. So maybe they're missing that. Maybe that's something that they need. But the fact is, they're not playing well. But it's not just two people's fault.
I'm not sure Neuer was saving some of those goals either, to be honest.
Organizationally.
Shout
stuff.
Out to Leva as well, by the way. Two goals for Robert Lewandowski.
Well, of course. That's what he does, isn't it? But anyway, Juventus need an injury time goal from Danilo to avoid defeat away to Atalanta. Gab, a week ago, some were wondering whether they could even just get back into the title race.
Yeah, which I think, you know, let's get back to earth. I know Atalanta were sliding here, but, you know, the gap was atop and the fact that there's, at the time, there were three teams in front of them, they weren't going to get back into it. It's funny. They played really well for the first 20 minutes. I mean, really well. Could have scored. Mm-hmm. Vlahovic, Dybala, it was all clicking. And then it kind of fell apart. And I think they were fortunate, not just because they got the injury time equalizer, but because Hans Hattabor, wide open with one of the potential misses of the season, sending the ball against the crossbar. there's positives to take away. I like the fact that he's sticking. Dybala played really well. It's amazing what an expiring contract will do for you. Morata, a bit less so. But I think it's worth sticking with. Look, I think it's going to be, I mean, I think they probably will finish top four. But, you know, let's leave the title race stuff aside. Let's find the identity. Oh, and they missed Zakaria already in midfield, I thought. Mm-hmm. Hard-fought win for Liverpool away to Burnley 1-0. But, Nathan, Sean Dyche's side actually had more shots on target. Is this a cause for concern for Jurgen Klopp? Were you impressed, or are you like, oh, no, it's Burnley, it's tough conditions. Hold on,
we got this. Well, both things can be true. I think it is Burnley, and the conditions are tough. But there's still one, but there's still a level of concern because I saw some of the chances which weren't on target. I think Weghorst had a couple of really big mm-hmm. ones. But the fact is...
Yeah, did he have one that went out for a throw-in? And were you praising for getting in that position?
But yeah, like he moves quite well. It's like it's almost like a giraffe the way that he runs. He's just so big, but he's still covering the ground. There was one which Alexander-Arnold kicked over the bar, which was actually going wide. And another one which he volleyed wide as well. But I think in some ways it's good to see Burnley creating chances because, you know, if they're going to be staying up this year, they'll need to do that, but they'll just have to take them because up until this point, I think they're probably second or third lowest scorers in the division. So there's a bit of pressure there. But for Klopp, the fact is the team found a way to grind out result, kept a clean sheet. So off we go. So Marco Reus bags two goals as Borussia Dortmund gets a huge away win at Union Berlin without Erling Haaland. Gab, how can they be so hit or miss?
Yeah, I don't know how they did this either. They didn't just have Haaland out. They had like half a dozen guys out. And, you know, away trip to Union Berlin, the Alte Försterei, everything is set up mm-hmm. for another car crash. But no, I think it was helped that you scored two goals in the first half hour. Marco Reus was very much on fire. I know it's a cliche, it's a captain's performance. I think it also helped that Manuel Akanji was forced to play right back. Which meant that, hey, look, we actually have a real defender there, not somebody's going to wander up the pitch and leave Zagadou exposed. And I think it shows that the players haven't given up, yeah. which is encouraging. Haven't given up in terms of performing, trying to perform for the team, that they have some pride. That, I think, is encouraging.
Yeah.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
Manchester United are held to a draw by Southampton. It's three draws in a row now. Nathan, Ralf Rangnick points to the expected goals, suggesting that they've been the better side by far in each of those games. Did they look the better side to you against Southampton?
They absolutely did not. I understand XG. I totally get it. I'm an XG fan now. But in watching that game, there were so many flaws which you could see in terms of how United played, lo and behold, especially in the second half. And they just looked so open. At times, it felt like there was a direct split. Attack, defence, the game was open. And Southampton were very confident. They enjoyed that stage. Whereas for United at times, it kind of felt like, you know, they hoped something would happen and they didn't really know how it was going to. So the XG is there, but I don't think many United fans enjoyed that performance.
I think it was also they had the two chances early, which were high XG chances. And then after that, you need to defend.
Yeah.
Either you defend high up the pitch by pressing or you defend further back. If they don't do that, then...
The talk was that Varane's coming in so they can play 2v2 at the back. Because Solskjaer said, you know, other than that, they need two sixes. Well, it looks like they need two sixes and more than two at the back. Because right now, teams are very encouraged. Napoli and Inter share the spoils at the Maradona Stadium, which means they remain a single point apart. Gab, who will be happy with the result?
I think Napoli will look to the fact that Handanovic made that great save at the end. And, you know, Zielinski hit the post. But realistically, this was... a can't-lose game, not a must-win game for Napoli. And for Inter, it obviously was a can't-lose game. So I think in the end, and you saw that the way the game developed after Dzeko's equalizer, I thought both teams are like, okay, let's live to fight another day. It's so tight. Three teams and 3 points. Inter, of course, second with the game in hand. I think they can live with that. I think Napoli totally can live with that. Manchester City rest Kevin De Bruyne, Rodri, and Jean Cancelo, but still wipe the floor with Norwich 4-0 as Raheem Sterling gets a hat-trick. Nathan, I kind of feel like we take performances like these for granted. Norwich were on a good run, and boom.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And it's because, you know, City have won so many games, but they're playing against a side that's down in the bottom three, so obviously they're going to win. But it, as you said, it's the performance. The result's the result, but it's the performance. And I think
Norwich were on a great run. They had two wins and one draw in the last three games.
Hold on. A great run is a reach. They're on a far better run than has been on at any point so far this season.
7 points from three games.
It's a far better run.
And they won the FA Cup against somebody.
And they're still in the bottom three. So I understand what you're trying to say, and they were better. But I think for City, they can make changes, but the system and style remains the same. And I think that's the bigger thing. I think that's the thing about the performance, which is key. Because we only see this, in my opinion, with maybe a couple of sides at the moment. And City certainly are one of those.
Your bias against City is staggering.
That's the first time I've heard that one. Anyway, Milan beat Sampdoria 1-0 to move into first place in Serie A. Gab, it was all about Rafael Leao.
It was all about him because of the goal and the way it came about. You remember Ederson to Raheem Sterling, ball over the top, yes, and he runs into it. This is the same thing. On Super Bowl Sunday, we kind of got to see. Like Mike Maignan channeled his inner Pat Mahomes. Milan, though, were smart because, you know, Milan like to play from the back. They sucked Sampdoria in, and boom, Mike Maignan. Yes. Rafael Leao, though, still had a lot to do. Tremendous touch to take it away from Berezinski, who is a really, really quick defender, and then a tremendous finish.
So you're saying Milan are a long ball team? That's
I'm saying.
Oh, is that lost in translation?
You need to mix it up. And big from Rafael Leao as well, because after he was really poor, I thought, in the derby, and to come back like this. Mm-hmm. Real Madrid are held to 0-0 draw away to Villarreal, and with Karim Benzema out, Carlo Ancelotti, who's been having auditions for the centre-forward role. One week it's Isco, one week it's Rodrigo, one week it's Asensio. Weirdly, it's never Luka Jovic, who actually is a centre-forward.
Wow.
This time he started Gareth Bale, who we hadn't been seeing him on the pitch since August. Needham, he actually did well. Does this mean he has more to give?
Well, more to give than nothing if he's not been involved. But I understand, Gareth Bale is still a very, very good player. Can he be consistent from this point forward and have these sort of like good performances between now and the end of the season and be trusted? I don't know. I literally don't know, because I feel like for the past few years we've not seen that. Gareth Bale today is very different to Gareth Bale from just a couple of years ago. So I'm not sure. I believe that he can. And for Real Madrid, maybe they need him to if they want to be really, really successful outside of La Liga. But I don't know. I'm not fully buying it anymore.
If I were of a cynical mindset, like some people
were,
in Spain,
if you were,
I might suggest that maybe it might have something to do with Wales playing some pretty important World Cup playoff games
next
month.
That's extra cynical. So anyway, Sevilla, they're 4 points behind Real Madrid after gutting out a 2-0 win over Elche on Friday night. Gab, do we have a title race in the Liga?
Of course we do. It's the 4 points, as they say in Spain. Hay Liga. There is Liga. I wasn't pretty. I think Papu Gomez ended up scoring, 20 minutes from time in the end. They're certainly nervy. But they're grinding out the points, and they're there. I think, you know, they still have to play Real Madrid. And then it becomes a one-point game. And then at that point, if Sevilla win, obviously.
I was going to say.
But
just play them and they just get 3 points instantly.
It's the second tightest race in the Big Five after Serie A. So for now, let's hope we've got a Liga race. Paris Saint-Germain leave it late to beat Rennes 1-0 as two guys named Messi and Mbappe combined to score an injury-time winner. I'm assuming they were just looking ahead to the Champions League and they're like, we've got our 28-point lead or whatever it is.
Is it 28? I thought it was 30. No more?
No.
Yeah, I think it could be easy to just have these look-ahead games. Like, Rennes are a good side. But PSG, they have the quality and they have those two guys, as you've mentioned, who at any point could win a game. So until that final whistle is blown, it always feels like they're in with a chance. And they did it. They scored. And it's like, we did it. We're now like extra ahead. But yeah, it's Champions League week now, and I think that's going to be the big thing.
Poch hoping to get Neymar back as well.
Yeah, it would be nice. Right, a late Mario Hermoso overhead kick gives Atletico Madrid a 4-3 win at home against Getafe. Gab, once upon a time, Diego Simeone was known for his staunch defending.
Yeah, now Atleti have conceded more goals already this season than they have in any Simeone's season since he's been at the club.
Wow.
It's remarkable. I want to say a word on Hermoso, and you'll appreciate this as a defender. If you watch Atleti against Barcelona, he got schooled over and over and over again by Adama Traore, who pretty much made him his female dog. Here, in the 89th minute, he scores an overhead kick to win it. I mean, for a defender, that's got to be pretty special.
Yeah, of course.
Beyond that, Atleti had a bunch of guys out, but even when they're fit, you don't know how these pieces fit together. It was nice to see Correa start. He scored a couple goals. I think Correa should play all the time at this stage. And they're in the hunt. They're both on their level with Barcelona and Real Sociedad a point behind. Mm-hmm. Speaking of late goals, Craig Dawson grabs an injury time equalizer for West Ham away to Leicester City. Nadim, their Champions League hopes are alive and well. Yes, they're still in it.
Yes, they're very much still in it. I think it was probably 3-4 weeks ago I saw all the teams behind them had games in hand. And if they won those, then they'd be in seventh. Right. Now all of a sudden they're in fourth and all the teams behind them are losing. But what can you say? So wild game for Jose Mourinho's Roma away to Sassuolo as they need an injury time equaliser and goal line technology to get a point on the road. And, you know, it's never dull, Jose, is it? Especially when Rui Patricio has an absolute stinker.
Yeah, I think Mourinho would love to have dull games that he just wins and gets the 3 points without drama, without controversy, like he used to have earlier in his career. They had no Nicolò Zaniolo in this game. I think they missed him. They were all over the place. Rui Patricio threw one into his own net. At the end, and Sassuolo, again, down to 10 men. All sorts of things happen in this game. At the end, it takes Brian Cristante's finish for the equalizer, cleared off the line, but then, thankfully, goal line technology. The Athletic reporting that Manchester United feel football director John Murtaugh and technical director Darren Fletcher are overworked because they have a lot of people reporting into them. And so they plan to hire a deputy football director to share the burden. Somebody who could, you know, look, I work for a big corporation like Disney, right? We've got like dotted lines and workflows and whatever. This makes no sense to me. Does it make sense?
It makes no sense to me at all either. And when we say they're overworked, like, does that mean that they're not doing their job well enough so they need someone else to come in and make it easier for them? I'm not sure. And it just seems like a parody every time you hear one of these stories from Manchester United. Like, most teams have got their setup in line. It's been like that for years and years. But no, in 2022, we need a deputy football director because the other two guys, there's too much work.
Well, the funny thing is, remember how, like, for the last 3 years, all these people who, like, you know, get regular briefings from United and so on, they're all talking about, we're going to appoint a director of football or sporting director. We're doing a wide-ranging search. And who knows, maybe it might be Rangnick if he sticks around or whatever. Wouldn't that guy then sit above Murtaugh and Fletcher? And then there'd be a deputy. I mean, like, I don't.
And Rangnick next year, because he is supposed to be staying, or not next year, come the summer.
He'll be consultant.
So where does that fall in the sort of hierarchy of Manchester United?
It's just a way of paying him more money. I mean, no, in the end, they'll listen to him if they want to and then not listen to him, and you'll kind of be on retainer. To me, that this whole thing is weird. The only positive in this, it was suggested in The Athletic that they might be looking at other clubs to hire somebody.
Okay.
I think the way that so much of United is in-house, you know, on that side, on the player recruitment, on the scouting, you know, it's a positive, but it can also be a negative. If somebody can come in from another club just to be in the room and say, hey, you know, at Brighton, at Villa, at wherever the hell this guy worked, we did things like this, that could be a positive.
I agree with that, and I think it would be. But unfortunately, at times, with clubs like that, they believe that what's going on in-house is the best that there is anywhere else.
Well, of course it is, because they've been so successful the last decade.
Well, and you mentioned Brighton, the greatest person of Brighton coming in. Someone might still think, yeah, but you've been at Brighton. It's not the same. And no, it's not the same, but something definitely needs to change.
Maybe they'll hire Cheeky Geerstein to become deputy.
No? Listen, you've said it. I'm not saying anything else. So Ajax beat up 20, 5-0. But Gab, the talking point comes from the CEO, Edwin van der Sar, who revealed that we're aware of some of the accusations against Mark Overmars when they gave him a contract extension and a big bonus. This is not a good look at all, is it?
Yeah, so obviously Overmars forced to resign after it emerged that he had sent highly inappropriate texts to a whole bunch of women, club employees and other women. Look, I want to praise van der Sar and Ajax for being open about this now. Because they could have easily lied about being aware, or they could have misdirected. But it's not a good look. And when van der Sar says, as he was quoted as saying in these stories, that, well, we were in a tough situation because we didn't want to postpone his new contract and we didn't have time to investigate the allegations, I just have to say, why not postpone his new contract?
Yeah.
Why not go to Mark and say, Mark,
agreed.
We've heard this disturbing information about you. We want to give you a new contract. We hope that this stuff isn't true. We have to investigate it. We're not going to tell anybody, and if it turns out that it's not true, nobody will ever find out. But we have to shed light on this.
Yep.
So, you know, good for them that they came forward later and he's apologized and whatever. But yeah, not a good look. You learn from your mistakes, right?
Hopefully.
After Austin Trusty, Arsenal are going shopping in Major League Soccer once again. Nadim, you've played many more games in MLS than I have, so I'm going to ask you. They've agreed
anymore.
A deal to sign goalkeeper Matt Turner from the New England Revolution. Turner, of course, also the U.S. men's national team keeper. I assume probably you played against him.
Yes.
Does any memories? And does this make sense, given that they already have Aaron Ramsdale and Bernd Leno?
So I think he's a good goalkeeper. And a lot of people over in the U.S. acknowledge and say, yeah, he's right up there. Very, very good. He's capable of playing outside of the league. So to see him leave the MLS to come to Europe, to come to the Premier League, like, I get it. But the Arsenal situation where they have Ramsdale, they have Leno, and now they have him. Those are three keepers who are very capable of being the starter for the club. So who becomes the third? I don't know. Who's the second?
Like, I mean, you would think they're going to move Leno on, although Jules keeps assuring me that everybody loves Leno. He's so good in the dressing room. He's such an asset. But I'm assuming if Turner comes in, he's not going to come in to be number three.
That's beware assumption, firstly. But I think with Jules, he's as he sometimes lets us know on social media, when he's right, he's right. So I think he must be confident with this one. But yeah, I don't know. You would think that you can't have three keepers of that sort of standard. Just not even fighting for one space, but like two people looking after just one guy. It doesn't add up to me.
I wonder, too, Turner obviously started for the U.S. in the last break. If he moves and he's going to sit on the bench, there's a World Cup coming up in Qatar in November, I've been told. What if he's sitting on the bench? Like, doesn't that impact him? And
I think,
you can just say, oh, look, Zach Steffen's sitting on the bench too. So
like, I think Berhalter knows who he wants to play and who he likes to play. And I think for goalkeepers, you might miss out on some reps. But the fact is, I think himself and Zach Steffen are still, in my opinion, the two best goalkeepers for that national side. And as long as they get some sort of minutes somewhere along the line, I think the trust is there. I don't think you can afford to drop him or drop either of them just because they're not playing in the Premier League.
Okay, I'm blanking on this as a City fan. Sorry, this isn't on the script. As a City fan, remember, it just really bugs me when you've got a name on the tip of your tongue you can't remember. Who was the Manchester City goalkeeper that was like the size of a building?
Costel Pantelimon.
Pantelimon, there you go.
Yeah,
sorry, it's apropos of nothing.
No,
Costel, if you're watching, we'll have you on the show happily.
Absolutely. That's
what was he like?
He was six eight or six nine. I remember Joe Hart was the smallest keeper, and he was 6'4" because it was him and two other giants. Bayer Leverkusen beat Stuttgart 4-2, and Gab, that's 14 goals in the last three games. They're unlikely to get into the title hunt, but it's four wins in a row for Gerardo.
Rico suave. I'm happy for them. They've got so much firepower. Verts and Diaby and Sheik, who scored again. I mean, I think it would only be good if they could at least challenge Borussia Dortmund for second. They're still a ways away. It looks like it's coming together. And I think this is a positive for the Bundesliga. They're fun to watch. They are conceding goals as well, of course. But that, again, I don't have a problem with it because they're generating a lot of chances and playing well.
Mm-hmm.
Spurs had asked their supporters not to sing a song where they referred to themselves as Yid, a term stemming from the word Yiddish, which some consider to be a slur, an anti-Semitic slur. Nadim, this is a complicated story because obviously Tottenham are identified or historically identified themselves as a Jewish club, and they say it's empowering. Whatever the case, a lot of the people singing this are Spurs fans who are not Jewish. And many defied the club's instructions.
I'm not surprised that it defied the club's instructions, because for them, I believe the fans will believe that the identity of the club runs through them and not just the person who's going to be telling them to stop saying that word. Like, they sing it with pride, whether there's a negative connotation which they believe exists with it or not. That's who they believe that they are, and it's something that unites big groups of them. And I think for some, you can explain to them why it's wrong and how people will be offended by it. But again, people always hold on to something that I believe they think is their identity. This is what it is to be Spurs. This is who we are. This is what we sing. This is what we do. And trying to break people away from that, it's not really going to work. And the more times you tell them to do it, the louder the songs will get. So I think there's going to be quite an impasse here, because I think people understand the overall conversation, but people aren't going to let go of that. Wouldn't you agree?
I mean, this is... I think there's two elements to this, right? There's kind of like, is it right? that they'd be told not to do it. It's difficult for me. I'm not Jewish. I haven't had the same experience. Mm-hmm. I don't feel qualified to speak on this. The same way I think sometimes people use words like this. People of color have used the N-word as an empowering way themselves and to do it. And I know that causes controversy. Mm-hmm. I'm not qualified to speak about that because I'm neither Jewish nor a person of color.
Yeah.
That said, so there's a whole element to that, and obviously a lot of Spurs fans are Jewish, but a lot of them are not. So there's a whole internal conversation to be had there. But what I do know is simply the club telling people don't do this isn't going to work.
Yes,
and I don't think the club are going to start throwing people out for doing it. It's an interesting one. There's been similar situations, although not necessarily with the sword. Obviously, Ajax are also historically the fans see themselves as a Jewish club, even though. There, the link was perhaps even more tenuous. So I think it's a difficult one. I think the more people bring this up and talk about it, you can say, hey, do I want to keep doing this if it upsets other people? And the fact that some Jewish Spurs fans don't care, others are upset by it.
I think
do you need to go and upset somebody to affirm your identity? That's the question I would ask.
Yeah, I think for me, that's the key bit there. I think if thousands upon thousands of Jewish Spurs fans say that they take huge offense to it, then maybe the tone will change, because I think the change comes from within that group itself. But if it's for people who are external, they're just going to sing it louder and louder and even more so in your face, in my opinion, but we'll see. So Milan may be top of Serie A, but Frank Kessié got a rough ride from his own supporters as they put up a banner criticizing him for his salary demands. Gab, what's going on? How much money are we talking about here?
So he's currently making, quick math in my head. He's making about 2.2 million euros net a year, which is roundabout, if you like your money in pounds per week, is maybe around 65 grand a week, something like that. He's asking for three times that. He's asking for 8 million euros net, which is a lot of money. It's, again, Rio, it's going to be about, what, like 200, just over 200 grand a week.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's worth it to the right club if you can afford him, because he's a phenomenal footballer and he's young, and Milan want to tie him up to a long-term contract. Milan have said they're not going to go that far. So inevitably, fans are annoyed. I think the people focused on this banner a lot because obviously he scored a great goal in midweek in the Coppa Italia. It came on, and is it right that, you know, you'd be criticizing your own players? Personally, I think the banner was actually respectful. Like, you know, basically says, like, if you don't want to be here, go. It wasn't say, like, you know, you're a greedy such and such, right? It is a bit jarring when he gets booed, when his name gets called, but and it's interesting because obviously they did this at Milan, they did this before with Donnarumma as well, who also wanted certain demands, and Donnarumma, I think, kind of escaped it because the grounds were closed at the time for most of the year. But look, from Milan, say, like, worked out fine for us. Donnarumma left, we got Mike Maignan's, who's, you know, about as good and costs us a lot less, and we can live without Kessié too. But have you been in situations where you've had teammates where it was a public expiring contract, and are they going to move on to another club or whatever?
I think when it comes down to contract negotiations, the PR is far better with the club than it is with the player, because it is a negotiation. So to both sides, we're trying to find an agreement, but they start from two different points. So when it's not working out, it can be very easily spun that it's because the player wants too much. But who's to say that the club might not just give him just a little bit less than that? Because the player wants to say, I imagine, otherwise it wouldn't be in negotiations. So I think unless someone says that they don't want to stay, unless you pay them £1 billion a second or €1 billion a second, then yeah, I think, as I said, for me, you don't have the leverage as a player when there's a negotiation, your contract's running out, because people just think you're greedy if you don't sign it. And then if you leave, then that's the reason why, because you want so much.
There's also another element too. You say the player wants to stay because he's negotiating.
Yeah.
Well, if Kessié came out and said, no matter what contract you offer me, I want to leave.
Yeah.
That would have a negative knock-on effect 100%. Too, right?
Yeah.
So he has to kind of pretend that he's still negotiating. But if that's his price, I mean, I said they're not going to meet it.
You would think. Do you think he reaches that price anywhere? Do you think that's how much money he's going to get in his next deal, wherever it is?
I think he's that young and he's that good on a free transfer. I mean, look, if I were to apply for, if United were to recruit me for the deputy football director,
that's what you'd bring in.
Like, no, I would go, hey, United, you can get this guy. Yeah, it's 20 grand a week, but there's no transfer involved. give him a 3-year deal, 4-year deal, whatever it is. It's not going to get worse. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not going to do any, and he's not going to be worse than these guys that you have. And you have another all-action, busy, hardworking, intelligent central midfielder, right?
I get you.
Who can play with me? I think there's a lot of clubs where he'd be a great sign. He'd be a great signing for Real Madrid as well. You know, maybe a long-term alternative to Casemiro. I mean, I think he's in a strong position.
Yeah, I feel like from externally, some fans could make it almost feel like a contract negotiation is the club says to the player, we want to offer you a new contract. Here's the contract. Player says, yeah, cool, I signed, and then that's it.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way, does it?
Yeah, not even close.
For the first time, the Premier League will be earning more money from overseas media deals than from domestic ones. This is in the next media cycle. Nathan, this isn't surprising as it was heading in that direction because obviously we've seen the rights holders here, BT Sport and Sky, it's an open secret, taking hits and you know, the deal's not increasing, whereas in the rest of the world, you can still find places where it's growing. In the long run, if the money comes in more from abroad, than it comes from, than it comes domestically. Is that going to affect maybe some of the decisions in the way the league is run and the way it's marketed? Because they are running a business, right?
Yeah,
they really have the foreign owners.
They are, yes, they are. They are definitely running a business, and maybe there will be slight changes. But maybe some of those changes, they happen in a way whereby people, I think, who are in the UK in terms of how they watch their games, it doesn't really change. Like, as a player, you don't really, or just, in fact, someone who just pays attention to the league, you don't realize how big it is until you start to venture out and see the coverage that exists elsewhere. So maybe there'll be a ton more expectations put on the clubs and the players to be flying out to this place to do some media work here, flying out to this other place. But if you're somebody, say, based in England, you're not going to know that. You're not really going to see that. And nor does it really affect your coverage of it. And I don't think strategically the sort of the nature of the league itself will change. But a lot of the stuff on the periphery, I think it has to, because that audience has to be acknowledged. Like, if that's where the money's coming from, it has to change.
I tend to agree with you. And I think what people often forget with this is, yes, the overseas contract is bigger than the domestic TV contract, but that's not the only way clubs make money. Clubs still make a ton of money. I think it's roughly a third at most clubs to 40% from gate receipts, from box office, from the fans who actually go to the game. And the vast majority of those games are local. They're people who live in England. And on top of that, they're much more visible and they're much noisier. And they're the people, I think, that you cater to first and foremost. For all this talk of globalization, in the most globalized league in the world, most of the money still comes from whatever country they're in.
Moving to Serie B, Brescia announced that they had sacked their manager, Super Pippo Inzaghi. But then 48 hours later, they withdrew their statement. Gab, what's going on here?
I think this is the first time in years that we've talked about Serie B, Nathan, so I thank you for that question.
It's my pleasure.
I think this is a funny story. Brescia are owned by Massimo Cellino, the former Cagliari and Leeds United owner, who has a very high opinion of himself and many, many things. And but clearly on this one, he can take the L for the way this contract was signed because they sacked Inzaghi, and then Inzaghi's lawyer came back and says, you can't sack me, because he actually wrote in that he cannot be sacked if Brescia are in the top six positions in Serie B, which they currently are. So how this came out, how they kind of announced that he's been relieved of duty, and then they're like, oh, wait, look at the contract. Oh, no, damn, we can't sack him. I don't know. I just thought that was hilarious. I wonder if more people are going to do that. More people are going to try to put clauses in and say, like, hey, if I'm in the top four, you can't sack me.
I wonder what else is in there, though, because that's very manager favorable.
The Football Association is looking to trial body cameras for referees in non-league football as a way of protecting them from the abuse they can get on parks and whatever. What do you think?
I was wondering why they were doing it. But if it's to sort of prevent abuse, then yeah, that's fair enough. But one thing I would say, though, some of the referees I've heard across the years, they do say a few things which maybe they hope wouldn't be caught on camera against themselves as well. So I get it. If, you know, they shouldn't feel unsafe on a field, but
maybe it gets them to behave as well and wards off lawsuits.
Possibly. So former Sampdoria striker Francesco Flacchi came back to play non-league football on Sunday after a 12-year absence. Gab, he's 46 years old. Where has he been all this time?
Well, he's been banned from football. He got a 12-year ban. For those who don't know, Francesco Flacchi is like a cult hero at Sampdoria many, many years ago. Maybe like 15, 18 years ago, where he played with Bazzani up front. People said, oh, look, they're the new Mancini and Vialli. Yeah, like, right, as if. But he was one of those very super talented number 10s, fun to watch, extroverted. He's also somebody who, by his own admission, had enjoyed the high life, enjoyed his coke. So he also got involved in an attempted match-fixing scandal, which got him banned once. Then he got busted for cocaine, which got him banned a second time. And then, age 34, he got busted a third time for cocaine. And at that point, you're done. That's why, instead of giving him a lifetime ban, they gave him 12 years, figuring it would be the same thing as a lifetime ban. I met him once. He is obviously a character. I think he's somebody who recognizes he's made a ton of mistakes. And for me, I believe once you do your time, it's over.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that he's back on the pitch. I don't know that he's going to play much more. He played half an hour at age 46. He can still ping it around. Good for him. Right. That brings us to an end, Nadim. Thank you for coming in. I'm going to be back. You won't. I don't know who we're going to have. But on Thursday, because the Champions League is back. Yes, and I am hyped and amped because my heroes don't appear on stamps. Until then, love the game. Love your neighbor. Love yourself.